Hello, I'm Father Benedict Rochelle of the Franciscan Friars of the Renewal from the South Bronx, and this is the 13th and last segment of our series on Christian devotion or personal devotion to Jesus Christ. And I thank you for staying with me during this series in which we've discussed Christian devotion, which, again, I define descriptively as a vibrant belief and conviction that Christ knows me, that he hears me, that he cares for me, that he expects things of me and forgives me when I repent of my failures, that he arranges my life by his providence for my salvation, that he waits for me when I close my eyes in death, and that I extend this conviction, which I have about myself, to those around me, those dear to me, to those who are devout Christians, to the whole world, that he knows us all. And today I'm going to take up the question, who will Christ be for us in the 21st century, in the new millennium? Now, the first thing you might say to yourself, well, Christ will be who he's always been. And that's Christ in himself, yesterday, today, the same forever, as we say in the Easter Vigil. But I'm talking about who Christ will be for the decade or two that's coming up. We've seen in the course of these 13 segments how he has been different things at different times. He was the companion of the martyrs, the King of Kings, the crucified King, the baby Jesus, the crucified Messiah, that he was the divine physician, the caring and broken and sacred heart, that he was the divine mercy. He has many things. Christ, to people who are victims of social injustice, is a liberator. Cardinal Nicholas of Cusa said, you know, to the king he is a king, to the prince he is a prince, to the beggar he is a beggar, to the condemned man he's a condemned man. To everyone, we all find something of ourselves, something of our lives in him, because he suffers not only for us, but with us. In him, we suffer, and he suffers in us. But let's ask the question, who he is going to be, who he is becoming in our own age. Now, I'm asking this question very largely in the Western European and American civilizations, which are highly mechanized, where there is a good deal of prosperity or economic life. He will be something rather different in Africa, in some parts of Latin America, in the Orient. In some countries, he is still the martyr's friend. Who will he be to what some call the first world and what I call the submerging world? I'm not so optimistic about its future. The first thing we have to do is take a little look at who people are psychologically in this more affluent segment of society, of the human race. We are the loneliest people who have ever lived. It's the loneliest time in human history. Most of us, three or four generations ago, came from people who had large extended families. For the most part, orphanages, old age homes, even hospitals were not so necessary, because people were taken care of in their extended family. orphans had a place to go. But as industrialized society came in and people became more affluent, the family became smaller, less extended. If you ever come to New York, I'd suggest that you go to see the marvelous exhibit at Ellis Island. It's the Immigration Museum, and I take our brothers there, our new brothers, every year. I'll be taking 12 or 15 of them shortly over to Ellis Island. And there we see marvelous photographic studies of the faces of the immigrants, the 16 million people who passed through New York Harbor from other countries to become Americans between the Civil War and the First World War. And what you see is families. Families held together by a common bond, by the desire to come to the New World, to find a better life. There's a marvelous picture in Ellis Island of a Lebanese family around the turn of the century. And there are 136 people in this family picnic, and all the fellows are wearing white shirts and ties, and they're all holding a bottle of beer up like this, and all the ladies are sitting around. You know, in a family like this, you didn't even need life insurance. It was an extended family. Now we have what is called the nuclear family. Father, mother, couple of kids. The grandparents live hundreds, if not thousands, of miles away. The husband is likely to be transferred by decisions that have nothing to do with the welfare of his family. And perhaps the word nuclear has its most important meaning in that the family might blow up. Wherever you go, you realize you're talking to very large numbers of single parents. Parents in single parent homes trying as best they can to raise children. Or you find divorced or separated parents who share the child. Now, they do the best they can or try, but it's not like that wonderful old extended family. Even people my age remember the extended family much more than it exists now. Recent demographic studies of Western Europe have become alarming, because families are so small. There are perhaps one or two children. It's predicted that in two more generations, the vast majority of people will have less than 10 close relatives. They will not have more than 10 or 12. I think this is deplorable. It not only passes a judgment on the contraceptive mentality of modern times, but it points out the absolute danger of interfering with natural processes in an artificial way, so that civilizations may very shortly have severe economic problems because there will not be enough working people to take care of the elderly people, and there will not be enough people to fulfill necessary jobs. In the United States, we would feel this very severely, except for our ongoing immigration. It's sad to see how much we resent immigration in this country, and yet the immense number of tasks that are done by immigrants. The next time you eat a meal out, just think of the number of people who were not born in the United States who have provided that meal and perhaps served it and cooked it for you. It's an interesting question. Where will we go in these coming lonely times? But the times are not only lonely because the family is becoming small or microscopic. They're very lonely because of the ethical philosophy or unethical philosophy of our country. Some years ago, about in the 1980s, a brilliant social psychologist, Professor Daniel Yankelevich, studied what he called the new ethic or the new rules in the United States. Professor Yankelevich was the research professor of social psychology at New York University. And he said we had moved from the family morality to a morality of selfism. The old family morality, which was universal, except in very wealthy aristocratic families, perhaps, was like this. I will take care of my family, I will provide for my family, and when I am no longer able to work, they will provide for me. And you could add to this that if I believe in life after death, they will see not only to my burial, but to the remembrance of me and prayer for me after I have gone from this world. That's the family. In the Catholic tradition, the custom of having the Mass offered for the repose of the soul of family members is still quite strong. And I'm often impressed when I see the Mass intention for the day. It may be somebody who's been dead for 20 years. And we have no idea how long in our time that journey takes on the other side, but it's a way of doing something. In a synagogue, the relatives of people are remembered, especially during the first year after their death. It's called the Yahrzeit. And the Kaddish, the prayer for the dead, is offered on the anniversaries of the month or the year, or as long as one wishes to, on the anniversary of the deceased. It's part of the family morality. What is the new morality? The new morality goes like this, and it's miserable. My first obligation in life, according to Yankelevich's analysis of selfism, is that I must take best care of myself and see to it that I activate all my potentials for enjoyment, pleasure, and accomplishment. The second principle of this horrible ethic is that if other people's needs or necessities get in the way of my needs, I must put myself first. And thirdly, and this is really crazy, in some way, I am entitled by the world to see that I accomplish all that I want and can, and have all the pleasure that I desire. That's crazy. This philosophy of selfism, according to many people, has undermined the United States. It's probably undermined many of the countries in Europe as well. It's very ill, and it probably indicates the end of Caucasian Western civilization. I myself think that we live in times similar to those of St. Augustine, when the rich and powerful Roman Empire disintegrated because of its own moral turpitude, and far less prepared people, who they called the barbarians, came in, and they built Western civilization on the ruins of the Roman Empire. Now, if we're right, if this is true about selfism, a few things we should know. Professor Yankelevich identified as perhaps the worst or most virulent, I don't want to put words in his mouth, the most obvious, I guess we could call it, symptom of selfism is abortion. The killing of a child because that child's existence is inconvenient to oneself. Secondly, Professor Yankelevich predicted that soon abortion on demand would cease in the United States. Well, we'll see. I think it's important to note that Professor Yankelevich never identified himself as a religious person, never said that these convictions were based on religious principles. He was just coming from sociology. But I'd have to agree with him. One of the things that Yankelevich did say is that selfism would destroy itself. And you, death, shall die, said the poet. It will destroy itself because it doesn't work. If you get two selfists, both with those principles, I come first, I must get all my potentials, and you attempt to marry them, you've married two people who can't marry. They can't combine. They're strangers. They're business partners. They're not married. Each one of them is a selfist, seeking his own or her own from the other person. And so they'll be terribly alone. Now, it's true that this kind of philosophy is most obvious in large cities among the more affluent people, the in-group, the movers and the shakers. But it seeps down into the rest of society. It moves out into a farming community in the Midwest, to a little farm where families have run the farm for 100 years. It reaches right into that family living room through the media, through television. And the same values that corrupt sophisticated people in large cities also corrupt simple people in small towns. Except that the people in large cities are better vaccinated. I'm a New Yorker, I'm a large city person, but I know where the whole thing leads. It leads down into the ground, into the grave. I can afford to hate the whole thing because I see what it leads to. It's amazing how lonely a big city can be. We have to warn our brothers who come to us, don't say hello to strangers. Don't have eye contact with anybody in the subway. You'll get thrown off on the tracks. Oh, it's not that we New Yorkers are unfriendly. You may think that if you come there. But we have been schooled by this culture that in this huge number of people, everyone must be closed in on themselves unless they reach out. And I watch our brothers reaching out to people, brothers who come from other parts of the world and sisters. And the New Yorkers are frightened. Somebody says hello to you in New York and you don't know them. They think they're going to be robbed or mugged or something. It's always delightful to me. I was just out to Lincoln, Nebraska, and I'm making this phone call, this broadcast from Birmingham, Alabama. My people are so nice, so friendly, so open. It's an extended family. But that's not where it's going. Oh, no. We have embarked on selfism. And selfism, although it seems soft and fuzzy and peachy, it really is the loneliest teaching in the world. The ancient Romans had a phrase, homo homini lupus, every man a wolf to his neighbor. That's where it is going. Now, in such lonely times, who will Jesus Christ be? Can I read to you? He says this, and he has made it known to us. This is from the Gospel of St. John, right before the death of Christ. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends, the opposite of selfism. You are my friends if you do what I command you. No longer do I call you servants, for the servant does not know what his master is doing. For I have called you friends. For all that I have heard from my Father, I have made known to you. You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you that you should go and bear fruit, and your fruit should abide. I have called you friends. For all of us Christians, I think that Jesus Christ, our eternal God and King, our brother in the human race, born of the Virgin Mary, must be our friend. And he is there to be a friend to us. My good friend, St. Teresa of Avila, in one of her prayers says, I was so alone. Alone I was, with no one to console me. And I sat for hours and hours, fearful and not knowing what to do, afraid that I was being deceived by the devil. And then I remembered, she said, that no matter what I was suffering, Jesus knew about it. And then I said to him, Christ, what a friend you are to those who will be your friends. St. Teresa goes on and said, I wish that I could tramp through the whole world and tell everyone that they should allow Jesus to be their friend. I'm convinced that in the lonely times ahead, religion will survive and thrive among those who've had it with the loneliness of selfism. This may mean that although children are introduced to religion when they are young, they may, because of the pressure of the culture, fall away for a time. This is becoming, unfortunately, standard operating procedure. But they will remember and they will see that there were people around them who had a purpose and direction in life, a nobility of purpose, people who were able to share, to be concerned, to reach out to others, perhaps even to lay down their lives for their friends. Such a person was Mother Teresa, and she caught the attention of the world. Everyone listened, and it was amazing, because she had a message that selfism did not want to hear. When Mother Teresa was given an honorary doctorate at Harvard University, I was annoyed to death. And I told the sisters, missionaries of charity, what in the world are you letting Mother Teresa get an honorary doctorate from Harvard? What could those people possibly give Mother Teresa? It's like making Jesus a Monsignor. It was silly to me. Well, she went up, and I wondered why she went. She thought, cared nothing for earthly honors. And yet, you only have to get a couple of honorary doctorates in your life to find out that it's a very hollow shell indeed. But off she went, and Harvard Yard was crowded. And when I heard what she did, I couldn't believe it. There in Harvard Yard, at the graduation, she spoke for half an hour on the beauty of virginity and chastity. I want to tell you, she gave them an honorary doctorate. They got it right back between their eyes. And a whole lot of people who thought they knew a lot of English words bought dictionaries that afternoon in Harvard Yard to look up chastity. They didn't know what it meant. When Mother was speaking, and I had a friend who was there, there was absolute silence. And when she finished, there was absolute silence. And then there was thunderous applause for several minutes. Why? Because she portrayed for them a picture of something that they had not thought about. What Mother Teresa would call something beautiful for God. Greater love than this no one has but to lay down his life for his friends. We may be moving into the loneliest and most selfish time in human history. God bless the people that we so condescendingly refer to as the third world or the second world. They may indeed have more happiness than we do. But we in this so-called first world, this Babylon, we have an opportunity to escape from its hideousness. An author a few years ago called it, Anthony Burgess called it, the clockwork orange, the phony piece of equipment. We have an opportunity to escape, and it is to be a friend to God who will be friend to us. The Christian has an opportunity to have Christ as his own friend. Don't tell me it's an illusion. I've done it all my life. Since I was young, I knew that Christ was my friend. Even when I failed, even when I failed badly, even when I didn't know what to do, he was there. He said, I will be with you always. One of our friaries is located in the South Bronx, next to a famous but somewhat decrepit old cemetery. Oh, they're doing their best, but it's seen better days. It's called Woodlawn Cemetery. And sometimes I take the brothers for walks in Woodlawn Cemetery, and there are many famous people buried there, Victor Herbert, George M. Cohan, others. And I walk past the grave of Irving Berlin, great songwriter, and his best song was Always. I'll be loving you always, with a love that's true, always. Not for just an hour, not for just a day, not for just a year, but always. I think Irving Berlin may have been inspired by the words of Jesus. At the end of his earthly work, being ascending into heaven, and he said, and I will be with you always, even to the end of the world. If you know him, he is there always. Reach out to him always. Let him be your friend always. And then you will be prepared to love others who need you, who love you, who desperately long for someone to show them a bit of love. How often? Always. God bless you.